I've been blessed to spend 50 years just studying grouse. The more you study them and watch them, the more you learn about them and the more successful hunter you will be. When I hunt grouse, I choose to shoot only male grouse. If you skin out a rough grouse's head, by the way, the eye is exceptionally large compared to the size of the head. Very wide angle view and great depth perception. Grouse know you're there like when you shut the door in a car. They know you're in the woods and they're tracking you. Look at the bird's eye and you will shoot that bird in the head. If you let your vision go wide angle, you will notice the first flick of feathers. First movement of that grouse, you will notice it, and that gives you a real heads up on getting on that bird. When you flush a grouse, whether you miss him or kill him, take the time to watch, look at that situation. Why was that bird there?
Today we are very excited to be joined once again by our friend Tim Flanagan, author, bird hunter, photographer, man of many things, and a guy that's been at it for quite a while. Hey everyone, Nick Larson here, host of the Birdshot Podcast, the show that brings you conversations, stories, and traditions from all across the uplands. The Birdshot Podcast is presented by Onyx Hunt and supported by folks just like you via our Patreon community. If you want to stay up to date and not miss any of our upcoming episodes, be sure to subscribe and follow the show in your podcast player or on YouTube, wherever you're listening or watching today. Tap that button for me. Thank you for doing so. And with that said, let's get into today's conversation on the Birdshot Podcast. All right, everybody, welcome back to another episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Today, we are very excited to be joined once again by our friend Tim Flanagan, author, bird hunter, photographer, man of many things, and a guy that's been at it for quite a while. You're 80 now, Tim?
Yes, I'm an octogenarian officially in April.
How does it feel?
I feel young between the ears and a little old in the legs. Too many miles chasing grouse and chasing outlaws as a game warden.
Well, it's maybe somewhat fitting because just last month, Tim, I turned 40. So,
oh my goodness.
As a guy that just turned 40, you're twice my age. What would you share with me?
Life just begins at 40, really begins at 40. Right now, you really understand life. You know where you want to go. You've got your goals set and you know the game now. You're going to enjoy it. Every day will be more enjoyable to you after 40.
That's pretty awesome. That's a cool outlook. And I would say, well, I certainly am questioning myself all the time. I would say that's a fair assessment. I do feel like I have learned a lot in my first 40 years, and I'm pretty excited about putting that knowledge, wisdom to use over the next 40 if I'm so lucky.
You will find what I said is true. I was, when I was a game warden, I just turned 40 and I was picking up a roadkill along a highway, and I heard this car slowing down, and here it was the man who managed the Penn State deer pens where they, bred and raised deer before they became commercially popular. He pulled over and he says, "How you doing, Tim?" And I'm like, "Oh no, I just turned 40. He said, "Shut up and listen to me. Life just begins now. Start living your life now and the rest of your life will be wonderful." So that's good advice and I offer it freely and sincerely.
That's pretty awesome. I may have needed to hear that today, Tim. So I appreciate it. We're off to a great start.
Oh yeah. Well, you've built a foundation for knowledge, and now you have the knowledge to enjoy life to the max.
Yeah, yep, no doubt. Well, I've been chasing grouse for what I think is a fairly long time, but you have as well, chasing, observing, studying, pursuing all those things, and you've got a lot of accumulated knowledge. And anybody that has read your articles or your book, Grouse and Woodcock, we'll definitely know that. But we're here today. I want to give a shout out to a guest that we interviewed not that long ago, Brad Trumbo. He's out west. He had text messaged me asking if I had ever interviewed you before. And he remembered hearing you on a podcast at one point, which we then figured out was probably your first appearance on, it would have been the Project Upland podcast at the time, but that was episode number 99. I looked it up today, back in April of 2020. So dang near 6 years ago. And like I said, it's been great to have you back on. And I'm glad that Brad mentioned that, because you recently had an article in the Ruffed Grouse Society Covers magazine about really a day in the life of a ruffed grouse. And that was the spark for this conversation today.
Well, thank you. Thank you to him as well.
Yep, indeed. So what, I guess, what inspired that article? You'll appreciate this. I've got two boys. They are 7 and 4. And last night, our bedtime reading was your article on Upland Lifestyle, because they're into everything, and they're into, especially my younger one, he loves watching nature stuff, wild crats, all that sort of stuff. So he was pretty drawn in as I was reading the article. There was a lot of information in there, and I wasn't sure if it was maybe going to be too much for him, but he was pretty fascinated by it all.
That relationship and that interest is precious. That's just absolutely wonderful. The way that article came about is I've been writing and supplying photography to the Ruffed Grouse Society for decades. They use all of my photography for free if it's to promote the agency, to promote the society. If it's to sell something, then cover in a magazine, or like that article, I am paid for that. All other uses of my photography by the Ruffed Grouse Society is free. And that's grouse and woodcock. If you see live birds photographs in the RGS magazine, they're usually mine. It's my personal contribution to the conservation and wise management of ruffed grouse. I started hunting grouse when I was 12, shot my first grouse at 12. And I had two grandfathers who were both upland bird hunters, and they tutored me in upland bird hunting. And that's what we did. We cared very little about deer hunting. We were into the action of grouse and woodcock hunting. And both of those granddads had formerly had English setters, but when I came along, their legs wouldn't take the mountains. So we were hunting over beagles mainly, but we shot a lot of birds over beagles in clear cuts. The same sort of habitat that grouse loves today, that has not changed. Habitat is so specific for grouse and woodcock. When I went into the Game Commission training school, I was just turning 30, and we had a speaker one day who was my absolute idol, Dr. Roger Latham. He was the chief of research for the Pennsylvania Game Commission, and he was the outdoor writer for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. He was standing at the podium right in front of me, and by this time I had killed an awful lot of grouse and woodcock. And he stood there and said, "When I hunt grouse, I choose to shoot only male grouse." And I thought, wow. And then he said, "And when I hunt woodcock, I choose to shoot only male woodcock." He went on to talk about how he could identify all the trees and hawks flying and wildflowers along the highway while driving along. And I thought him very, very braggadocious. He sort of fell off the ivory tower I had him on. But then I finally realized what he was telling me was, young man, learn to see. Because we see with our minds and not with our eyes. You know, an example I use in my photo lectures is, if you show a photograph of someone of two 1957 cars, a Ford and a Chevrolet, and they're both red and white. They're red and white and chrome. We don't know the Ford from the Chevy with our eyes, but our minds do. As soon as we look at that picture, that's the Chevrolet and that's the Ford. That was his message. And if you learn the field marks of these birds and learn their natural history, you will be much more appreciative of them. But even more importantly, you'll be a much more successful and savvy grouse hunter. Pay attention to everything when you're in the woods and every aspect of the grouse. I can guarantee you, shooting sex selectively, only shooting males, is very easy to do once you learn the field marks. And it just takes you have to see a few birds. You have to see quite a few birds. But much about them is different.
I had forgotten about that. We may have talked about that on the previous time we had you on. If not, some people have mentioned that to me over the years. And it's kind of been, I have to say, ever since that came up, before you said that or somebody made me aware of you talking about that, I don't think I ever thought about, am I shooting a female or a male grouse on the wing? But ever since then, it's in the back of my mind, and I don't do anything really intentionally to shoot or not shoot based on what I see, but I am more observant of it now. And I've always taken that with me. And I would, equate it to almost like aim small, miss small, right? Like I'm, if you try to see it, there are things there. What I'm trying to say is I don't think I would have 100% conviction one way or the other until I get the bird in my hand. But I do feel like I now see and notice and observe things that probably with a better than 50% chance, if I get a good look at the bird, I think I have a pretty good idea is what I'm getting at.
Well, isn't that a great blessing? And then the other thing you will find, and I've kept meticulous records. I've done many years of hunting, and actually I'm kind of ashamed of the amount of birds I've killed. But guiding hunters, I watched intently and kept notes of every day I guided. The Game Commission used me as a guide for visiting dignitaries. I had good birds, and I had lots of good cover, lots of birds. What I notice is whether you shoot, and very few people try to shoot selectively, sex select.
Right. Yeah, I would say that's the vast, you know, it would be a very extreme rare minority, if anyone.
Yes. If you shoot every bird you shoot at, every bird you see, you will only kill 5 to 20% hens in rough grouse. In woodcock, you'll kill many more hens than you will males. They're just much more prevalent. They lead the migrations, and they offer better shooting opportunities. But 5 to 20% harvest of hens is typical, and that's because natural selection, you know, the creator made these birds to be survivals. In the there's an article in Gamekeepers of winter issue about called The Survivalist. Grouse know how to survive. Winter has no concern for them whatsoever. But hens are especially adept at surviving. When you shut the door on a truck along the edge of the forest and before you even begin the hunt, she knows you're there. And a hen grouse will slip away, and she hears you in the forest. She'll slip quietly away. By the way, grouse rarely fly, but she's going to run away quietly. And when she gets quite a distance from you, she may fly off, and they can fly silently. They don't have to do that roaring flush. The hens will always slip away. So they're much more elusive, and that's nature's way of preserving the species. We males are expendable, but those hens are very, very valuable. So that's one of the reasons I try never to shoot a hen.
It's one of those things where if it was more, you know, there's a reason that we shoot rooster pheasants and
amen,
only that, because they're much more easy for the average person to identify them on the wing, right? I think if grouse were of that sort of discrepancy, you know, in their feathering, the regulations would probably be different.
Yeah, it's very difficult for the normal everyday hunter to identify grouse sex on the wing. It's almost impossible unless you study it.
The silent flying, that's another one that, again, I'm almost certain it was you that sort of planted that little seed in my head. And it's always, I'm walking around in the woods and I'm thinking about these things, and it reminds me of a hunt this fall where I was out with my English setter Rose, and she was tracking a bird. And this just stands out in my mind for some reason. We were tracking a bird and moving and pointing as she does. And eventually a flush never produced, but I got to a point where I sort of turned my head at just the right moment. And I saw a bird flying away. It flew out of a tree and it was totally silent, yes, but it gave me enough indication where I was quite certain it was a grouse. And I remember thinking to myself, there was a silent grouse flying away out of a tree. So by your estimation, that would likely be a hen.
Well, it's very likely that was a hen. If you read that, the article you just mentioned, A Day in the Life of a Grouse, in the winter issue of Covers magazine, that hen will run away before, usually right before she runs, she'll drop a little bit, maybe a drop of hen or grouse poop. And that will give you a dog on point right now. One of the main scents we get from a live grouse, a dog gets from a live grouse, is the breathing and the defecation. A puppy's nose will always, on his first grouse, his nose will always go right to the vent. I apologize for my hands. I'm talking with my hands. But
yeah,
when she runs away, then the next thing she does is flutter up into a tree and watch the back trail for you. When she sees you approaching, she's gone. And that's exactly what you witnessed. A very smart, cagey hen grouse saving her life. It's amazing.
In reading that article, that was something that I noted down and kind of, the hen running, hopping up into a tree and watching the back trail. I mean, it certainly sounds totally plausible in theory, but how much of that is just your observation? You've seen hens do that, and it's just, does a lot of this knowledge just come from your observation over the years?
When working as a game warden, had a very open schedule. We made our own schedule. Later on, we went to 8 and 40, but never abided by that schedule. Worked hours and hours. I could hunt almost every day of every season. Unless we had a meeting to attend, a mandatory meeting or something, I was in the woods part of the day. And back when we had a lot of grouse, I would take a limit of grouse, two bird limit in Pennsylvania, every day. Plus, I hunted West Virginia, Maryland, and Michigan, and Maine for grouse. So I've seen thousands and thousands of grouse while hunting. And I've watched even more of them in the years that I put the gun away a long time ago when, when I saw the grouse population starting to drop in Pennsylvania. I put that 410 Browning away and strictly hunt with Nikons. And it's so much more pleasure watching and observing and recording these birds with the photographs than killing them. And right now, I don't believe I could kill a grouse, especially in Pennsylvania. The numbers are so low. But the more you study them and watch them, the more you learn about them and the more you appreciate them and the more a successful hunter you will be. That article talks about, especially towards the end, the more you know about the ruff grouse's lifestyle. And how I pitched that article is I talked to Brittany. The wonderful editor, Brittany, is just superb. And I said, Brittany, what would you think about an article about a day in the life of a grouse? Here's what a grouse does. And she said, that would be great. Could you combine it or confine it to the fourth quarter of the year? I said, yeah, surely. So that's how that article started. It ended up being like 3,500 words, which is a very long feature article. But throughout that, I talk about observation. When you flush a grouse, whether you miss him or kill him, take the time to watch, look at that situation. Why was that bird there? What kept him there? How did that bird act? What plants are there? What's the photography or the topography, the light conditions, the wind conditions? Every time you flush a grouse, study that, and it will make you a much more successful hunter, and you will enjoy every hunt even more. It also will lessen the miles you walk in the woods. Once you understand that's grouse cover, you will walk to that grouse cover. One of the deadliest hunters I ever encountered was a local fellow who never owned a dog, but he killed a lot of grouse, and he just walked them up. He'd walk the mountains for miles, but he didn't walk all over the forest. He walked from one hot spot to another. And interestingly, I checked him one day. I surprised him in the woods, and I was in uniform, and I looked at his gun, and it had no trigger guard. And I said, oh, how'd you break your gun? He said, oh, that's not broke. He said, this is a grouse gun. Grouse are fast. I don't want nothing in the way. He had sawed the trigger guard off of his gun so he could get on it faster on grouse. So that's a little extreme. But the point is...
Yeah, I don't know if I'd recommend that.
No. But the point is, pay attention to every minute you're in the woods, and especially after a grouse flush. Stop, take the time. Why was that bird here? And boy, this will increase your knowledge of grouse tremendously. Add that to memory. And if keeping a journal is so important, if you're a serious grouse hunter, keep a journal and note those things, especially the cover, time of day. Some of these birds are time specific. They'll be at certain areas. Well, in that article, I talk about a 3 o'clock grouse. I would always encounter him at 3 o'clock at a certain spot, another at 10 o'clock at a certain spot. They are habitual, and they're really habitual on habitat, the food sources at certain times of the year. And those food sources vary. You need to understand, be able to read the wild menu and understand where those food sources are so you can follow the grouse from these upland wetlands where there's all this soft mass in October. And then as the soft mass gets consumed, they're going to move on up the side of the mountain. In our area, they're going to start feeding on black birch buds and dried leaves and dried fruit from raspberries, blackberries, and witch hazel flowers. So it's just, if you learn the wild menu and pay attention, keep notes in that journal, you'll be a more successful grouse hunter.
Yeah, indeed. I think that was, you know, anybody that has read the article or does read it, I think, you know, there'll be a lot of stuff in there that they will probably know from hunting and pursuing grouse. But there were so many really like kind of fun factoids in there that I think the difference is, you know, as a hunter, and again, most of us are, we're so busy, like just trying to get eyes on a grouse for us for a split second to shoot it, you know, that's a different, we're seeing the grouse under this sort of templated point where the grouse knows we're there. We're trying to flush it. We're trying to get a shot, which is different than just observing the grouse going through its daily life. And I think that's where all of the most really interesting stuff in that article is, just, you don't get that when you're just flushing a bird to try to get a shot. You're observing the grouse doing all these things. And that's where it really put a smile on my face.
Yeah. I've been blessed to spend 50 years just studying grouse, watching them. And I did a lot of road hunting for grouse. When we had grouse, I would drive every day, every morning and every evening, driving mountain roads. We have I live in very rural country. I live in a town, but the country around here is all mountainous, game lands, a lot of game lands, state forests. And I would drive these roads every morning and every evening looking for grouse. And once I find, springtime is especially the best time to photograph grouse because the males are out displaying, you know, just trying to look good for those hens and draw attention to themselves. But once I would find a bird working a stage, a display stage, like an open area or drumming log, especially drumming logs are wonderful. Once you find one, you know, I'd set up a blind, or I would just spend time in full camouflage sitting in the woods where that bird was active and taking photographs. And it's interesting there, I've learned that their vision is wonderfully, wonderfully acute, and their hearing is second to none. We talk about how good wild turkeys can hear and see. The grouse is no slouch to that. And he has 270-degree vision and hearing that's it's just amazing. Yeah. Think of a shutter on a Nikon will make a grouse flush. There are a few especially if you shoot in rapid fire in continuous high, like click, 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 they're gone. If you one click every now and then, the grouse will tolerate that. But if it sounds mechanical, that grouse is gone. It's just not normal. They are that, I mentioned in there, an old time grouse or a turkey hunter said to me, nothing in the woods thinks more of its life than an old gobbler. I believe a rough grouse is the same way, especially a rough grouse hen. The males will tolerate a lot more than a hen will.
When you are sitting there, if you find a grouse evading you based on the sound of the shutter, where it's not, you know, it's not me dressed in blaze orange walking up and flushing the bird, what method are they using to escape? Are they just ducking and running, or will they hear that shutter and actually flush?
They will fly. They will flush. It's absolute fear. One of the things I had, I made a mistake of telling a friend who was a budding photographer where I was seeing a lot of grouse, and he posted it on Facebook, and of course everybody went there and ruined my photography. But at one time he told me, Tim, I was driving that road and there was a grouse flat on the leaves and it would not move. He said, I blew the horn, I yelled, and then he said, I finally went out and had to kick it to make it fly. And I said, my friend, I said, Ron, you killed that grouse. He said, what do you mean? I said, if grouse know if they fly, they die. That bird would not move because there was a goshawk sitting there, and he knew that goshawk was somewhere. When you made him fly, that goshawk knew where he went. You didn't see him kill him. That bird got killed. And that's especially true of these. Occasionally, I have an opportunity to photograph one of these grouse they call tame. And they're always males, and they're not tame at all. They're actually territorially aggressive. They will attack you, peck at you, flog you, and so forth. I just photographed one like that about 3 days ago. Those birds are very susceptible to avian predation because they're too bold. They show themselves. A grouse that shows himself out in the open is going to get eaten very, very soon. The Appalachian Rough Grouse Study back in the late 60s and 70s proved that 65% of all grouse predation is avian. And in that book is a chapter in a grouse woodcock book, A Death Comes from the Sky. And one reviewer said that's the best chapter in the book. About 35% of grouse predation is attributable to terrestrial predators. They have much less opportunity to take grouse, because they're so wary, especially a hen grouse. So God bless the hens for surviving so well.
On that, the bold males, I think maybe we might have even talked about that. It's coming back to me now. Like, because every once in a while, an article will show up
you know, the local paper where a guy drives his four-wheeler out and the grouse comes and jumps up on the four-wheeler. That it doesn't happen every year, but I've seen enough of those articles over the years. What about, will females do that in the spring, like when they have a brood on the ground? Will they kind of get aggressive towards people?
I've seen that a few times. The grouse, she does not get aggressive where she will jump on you and flog you, but she will puff up as big as she can and she'll hiss and sort of run at you. And she wants, as soon as she does that, those little chicks disappear. They meld into the leaves. They absolutely vanish right under the leaves, and plus her cryptic coloration, they just vanish. And once she knows they're out of sight, she's gone. And she wants you to follow her. She may even do the broken wing act to get you to follow.
Yeah.
She will act aggressive when she has young chicks. And by the way, those little chicks are precocial. They'll follow mama right out of the egg. They all tend to hatch the same day and follow mama on the day they all hatch. And they watch her very closely. After about a week, they can somewhat fly, a weak flying ability. But 2 weeks, you won't get near those young chicks. They're wild like mom, and when she flies, they're gone too.
Yeah.
They're amazing birds.
Indeed they are. Yeah. I think I have seen that hen behavior one time while I was mountain biking through the woods. Just kind of came around a corner and there was a grouse. And of course I stopped to look. And then I think she was doing that hissing. Just something about it told me at the time that it was a hen. And I'm quite certain it was. And I've heard that from a few other mountain bikers. It seems to be the mountain bikers in the woods that time of year are bumping into them.
Well, the mountain bike's a little quiet, so you tend to get close to it.
Right.
There's three really uncommon things to see in ruffed grouse's natural history. One of them is this aggressive hen with that we just described. The other is dusting. They dust usually every day, but it's a very secretive thing. And they're very, very, very quiet about that. The other thing that I have never found a person who has observed, and I've talked to hundreds of biologists or ruffed grouse society, various conservation groups, I have never met anyone who has witnessed the copulation of ruffed grouse. I have a photograph, I call it a incomplete pass. It's a male grouse reaching, it's early in the morning, and he's trying to mount a hen, and he's reaching out for her and trying to get her to stop. And she avoids him, but no one that I know of, other than in captivity, they do breed in captivity. But in the wild, I don't know of any biologist or photographer who has ever seen them copulate, actually engage.
In all your time sitting around drumming logs and stuff, you've never actually seen it.
And I've set up drumming logs in, one drumming log, for example, was very, very picturesque. And it was 65 miles from here. And I was there every morning for a month, the whole month of April, all but 2 days. I was there every morning at 5 a.m. The grouse would start drumming about 5:30, and he would drum till almost noon. I was there every day to record that. And even the drumming cycles and the rest periods in between, very unique and individual to each bird. When I was a game warden, I worked an awful lot of night patrol. It was my favorite time to work, catching night poachers. And sitting on watch out in the mountain, you would hear grouse drumming year-round, 3, 4, 5 in the morning in pitch darkness, because they become amorous as soon as the fall equinox changes and the days start getting shorter. At the fall equinox, they'll actually go into breeding mode and start drumming, and the drumming in the fall is not uncommon at all, especially at those wee hours of the morning. And they can see, they have exceptional night vision. In color vision, well, they have hawk-like vision. If you skin out a ruffed grouse's head, by the way, looking at a grouse, his eye looks just tiny. But if you skin out his head, and there's pictures of it in that book, the eye is exceptionally large compared to the size of the head, and it's flattened and it's amber colored. So the amber color gives it enhances the brightness of it. Very wide, so it has very wide angle view and great depth perception. Right behind that is a hole in the bird's head. Both sides of his head looks like it's been shot with a .22. Those are the ears. And there are very special feathers that cover those ears that act like these. They catch sound and put it right into that skull. So this bird, the ruffed grouse has a really large brain for the bird that size. and it is surrounded by a giant eye on both sides and two giant ears that tell it every danger that exists in the woods. And there,
the ears really are exceptionally large. And whether or not I had ever looked at it before, I'm not sure. But this fall, I'm standing around the tailgate with a buddy of mine, Kevin. We were talking about it, and he pointed that out. And it had been a long time since I had looked, if ever. He sort of peeled those feathers back, and it's amazing how large those ears are.
Yes, and the eyes. And that behooves a hunter to hunt silently and step carefully. I hunted with a father and son team that always were very loud and talkative in the woods, and I quickly learned to just stay to the side of them and kill the grouse that they flush. The grouse know you're there, like when you shut the door in a car. They know you're in the woods, and they're tracking you. So you need to be... You should avoid doing a lot of this. You have to wear the fluorescent orange. I don't think that bothers grouse. You know, it's required by law. But you should carry your gun at the port or high port ready position all the time, ready to react to that shot, but not be moving it around. You should never carry your gun over your shoulder or down at your side. For grouse, you've got to have that gun ready and be observant. The other thing you do is learn to use your eyes. If we look for grouse on the ground, when my dog's at point, I don't look for a grouse on the ground. I look above the dog and let my vision go wide. If you let your vision go into wide angle, and we can control that, a lot of people don't realize that. When you let it go wide angle vision, I can see my fingers moving clear out here. If you walk in on a point or while you're hunting and trying to walk up grouse, if you let your vision go wide, no tunnel vision, you will notice the first flick of feathers, the first movement of that grouse, you will notice it. And that gives you a real heads up on getting on that bird, getting on it. Never, never look on the ground for a grouse, because they're very difficult to see on the ground. And woodcock are even more difficult, as you know.
Yep. So, yep.
Well, we talked about the males being bold.
Yes.
I have so often seen young males, especially young of the year males, and young of the year males often look even more robust and bigger than an older male, because they've got all these new feathers that have to last them a year, where the male grouse is going to molt in the middle of the year in July. I've often seen these young males test the dog and tempt the dog, and they flick that tail. You'll see them walking away from the dog, flicking that tail. Well, the tail is the target they want the predator to hit. Because when you grab a tail feather of a grouse, it pulls out very, very easily, and they regrow them. You may have killed some grouse that have very uneven tails, odd-looking tails, a lot of feathers here, and then here's a couple little ones that are just growing in. He's had a close encounter with predation. And these young birds, they're so cocky, and it's like a teenage boy. You know, we're invincible when we're teenagers and 20-year-olds. They'll pop that tail and tempt that bird or that dog to attack that tail. It's amazing to see the boldness of these young grouse.
Yeah, it really is. It's a real test for those bird dogs.
Yep, the hen will not do that. They're fascinating birds, and they're such a challenging to hunt that every time I killed one, it was bittersweet. You know, to hold a grouse in your hand is to touch and feel the absolute essence of wildness. And having a grouse in a woodlot, but hallows that ground. Because they only live in certain places that suit all of their needs. And their home territory is rather small. A large home territory is 2 miles in a lifetime. And about an eighth to a half a mile a day moving around. And they always move around on foot. Grouse don't fly around their habitat. You know, they fly from danger, and they fly up to feed or roost. That's about it.
What other things, again, what things come to mind have you observed? Have you observed a grouse being predated? Like, have you ever been sitting quietly and seen an avian kill or anything like that?
I've found a number of sites where they were killed. The nearest one, I mentioned this online here recently. After January, after the winter solstice, as soon as the winter solstice passes and those days start to get a little longer, the male grouse go into breeding mode. They sense springtime. They become lustful springtimers. They know that breeding season's coming. A number of years ago, back when I was shooting just color transparencies, I've been photographing for decades, but we had about 2.5 feet of snow right at about the first of the year. And our game commission people were, biologists were concerned about the deer being able to move around at all because we were losing some. So our labor crews went into our game lands and bulldozed with the big D9 bulldozers, bulldozed the roads and trails open so the animals could walk in it. Well, on the 4th of July, I drove one of these roads and drove right up on a male grouse in full courtship display. He strutted up and just pirouetting around, and he's in the mood to breed.
And I kind of like that grouse over your shoulder there on the cover of your book.
Oh, yes, very much like that. But he was on a snow-covered boulder that I was very familiar with, this boulder along the road. And I photographed the daylights out of him with the color slides and then just backed away. I didn't want to interrupt him anymore. The very next day, I want to check on him again. And when I got there, I saw, oh, that's the grouse over there on the snow. And I looked at it through the camera and zoomed in. Yeah, the grouse was on the snow, but this was a goshawk on top. He had just killed the grouse. And in that book, there's a picture of the impact where the goshawk drove the grouse into the snow. My brother-in-law is a master falconer in another state. He was at a hawk meet where a fellow was flying a goshawk off his glove, and they flushed the grouse, and he said, "Tim, that goshawk hit that grouse, knocked it on the ground. They hit him in the air with their... They ball up their talons and hit it in the air." He said he knocked that on the ground as fast as you could have shot it with a shotgun, and then just turned over and grabbed the grouse. I was fortunate to watch that bird. I saw him right after he had killed that, moments after, and then watched him move that to a butcher block, which happened to be that same boulder. And completely, first thing they do is remove the head from the bird and eat the brains out. They lick the brain right out of it. That's their favorite part of a bird. And then he completely plucked that bird clean, cut the legs off, and I was out of the car and moving slowly and approaching him, sitting in the snow. And got a little too close. That bird, the goshawk, flew up in a tree, cached that naked body in a fork of a limb, looked at me, and flew off. I know he cached it for, saved it. You know?
Yeah.
It's amazing. But grouse are preyed on by predators from the day they're hatched, well, even in the egg, you know, the skunks and possums and cats and dogs, feral cats and dogs, black snakes prey on them even in the egg. So they're their ultimate survivalist.
Yep. And they do it every day, 24/7, 365.
And they elude us very, very effectively. And it's absolutely fair to say, and you'll hear a lot of people say, oh, hunting has no impact on, hunting grouse has very little impact on them. It's such a great privilege to hold one in your hand, and they don't come to hand readily and easily, as you know. They're the most challenging winged shot there is in North America, so he rightfully deserves the title King of Game Birds.
Yeah. I meant to ask you this earlier, so we kind of led off with it, but just in case anybody's scratching their head saying, how the heck would you do that? Let's start with a grouse and then go to woodcock. What are you looking for when those birds are on the wing to actually identify male, female?
Okay, we'll do grouse first. Hen grouse is much smaller than the male. He's obviously larger. She has shorter wings and a faster wing beat than the male. And the male, if you look at a male in his profile, his tail will appear to be a full third of his body, much longer tail. And he will almost always have an entire black subterminal band. About 25% of males will be variegated in the center two tail feathers. The hen's tail will be much shorter. It will look like one quarter of her overall body length. So here's a small bird with a stubby tail and an interrupted band with faster wing beat and a little faster. I think she actually flies a little faster than the male. And you'll see fewer of those. But those, well, it's actually four field marks. Size, wing beat, interrupted band, and also somewhat how they fly. Hens are much more prone to fly low and right through the cover where a male will most often, let's put it that way. It's hard to generalize, but he may give you a much easier upper shot rising up through into the open cover than the hen will. She will avoid you at every possibility. Woodcock are really easy to identify. And woodcock is notably she's a third larger than the little male. Male woodcock are tiny. When you see a woodcock flying, the first thing you notice is that beak. His is a little short beak. His is like this, and hers is much, much longer. Very noticeable. So you got a big, fat bird with bigger, with a much larger, they can have an 18, 20-inch wingspan on a woodcock. It's amazing how big their wingspan is. She's big, got a long bill. She's lighter colored than the male. The males are always darker than the females. So if you have a small, dark-colored bird with a short bill, that's a male. You shoot him. Males also are, they have a moniker called Labrador Twisters. The first migration of woodcock begins with hens. Almost every bird woodcock you shoot in the early season is a hen. Later, the males follow, and when they follow, they're much more elusive flyers. They just corkscrew through everything. They're much more difficult target. And woodcock aren't easy targets anyway. They're a point-and-shoot sort of target. You know, you need to be able to mount that gun and have it fire when it touches your shoulder. But size, color, length of beak, flight characteristics, woodcock are so easy to identify because they're so different. Woodcock or grouse are a little more difficult, but not at all impossible. So.
You may have said this, but the female woodcock, the hen woodcock, they tend to do that more where they kind of fly straight up, helicopter up versus the dipsy doodle of the males.
Yes. Not all of them do that, but the hens do tend to do it more. The males are much more elusive flyers that right through the cover, just corkscrew through the cover. Very challenging and usually a lower flight characteristic than the female. You're right.
Yeah. I think I have enough of those tidbits in my head where for me, it kind of, I shoot fast. So I think I see it and then I shoot and then I maybe am sort of pontificating in my mind. I think that was a male, you know, I think that was a male grouse and I probably, you know, if you see a big grouse get up ahead of you and that big tail fan, you know, I can see that it's a male, but if it's not that, then my accuracy probably drops a lot, but I am always curious to sort of make a guess in my mind and then go get it in my hand and kind of see if I was right or wrong. It's observation, you know.
My question, what do you look at when you're at your shooting? What are you sighting on when you're shooting?
I am never as good. I always want to, again, going back to that aim small, miss small, I'm supposed to be looking for the head, trying to get that crystal clear snapshot of the head. I'm not as good at that. I think oftentimes I bag enough birds to where, you know, I'm doing something right, but I don't think I'm not often enough have that crystal clear focus on the head. So sometimes I am just shooting at the blur of wings, but sometimes that's good enough.
You'll be much more deadly effective if you look at the eye. And woodcock, I always tried to shoot the tip of the woodcock's bill off. And the other thing you must know when you're shooting upland birds, you must know the pattern of your gun. And you should, very few hunters, upland bird hunters I know, pattern their guns. Turkey hunters do. They want to know, they want that full choke, you know, right there on the neck of that bird. But upland hunters rarely, I've met very few that really know the pattern of their gun. And I was guiding a fellow from out in Arizona or New Mexico, and he was a quail hunter and had him hunting woodcock. He'd never seen grouse and woodcock, and he killed a couple woodcock. I always wait till the end to shoot birds, you know, let my clients, or it wasn't a client, it was a friend. And he said, no, you shoot the next bird. And we were in an odd situation of a large overgrown goldenrod field. And the bird pointed out in the goldenrod. So when a woodcock gets up, it's perfectly in the open. It's an uncommon shot. Well, this bird started down across the field and I shot and it wobbled just a little bit. And it was a bang, bang. The second shot, it tumbled. And he started to laugh. Oh, I thought you missed that one. I said, no, I didn't miss him on either shot. He said, what are you talking about? I said, look at the bird's bill. And the tip of the bird's bill was shut off. It shot off. That pattern had clipped that tip of that bill off. And that's what we want to do. We want to shoot him in the head. Makes for better eating instead of picking lead. So.
Indeed. Yeah. But, yeah. I know what I'm supposed to do, but I have a hard time doing it sometimes.
Anytime we look at a photograph or look at a person, if we look at a photograph and there's a person and a dog there, our eye will go right to the person's eye and then to the dog's eye. We're drawn to eyes, and the new cameras now have special settings for eye focus, eye detection. look at the bird's eye and you will shoot that bird in the head. And
you certainly improve your odds, that's for sure.
Well, and keep that, you know, we're spot shooters, we're quick shooters, but we got to keep that gun moving. If you shoot skeet, when you break that skeet bird, follow it all the way to the ground. Make that a habit so that you follow through. One of the biggest mistakes in bird hunting is stopping the gun. You know, we get on target and stop the gun, we shoot, and the bird's here and the shot's here. The bird flew past. So keep the gun swinging and keep your eye on the eye.
Do you still shoot skeet or anything like that? Or is the Browning really just pretty well in the safe?
I shot skeet twice a week, 100 rounds a week, international style only for years. Never shot with the gun mounted, always shot. And encouraged the, back then we were using, we didn't have voice command pullers. And we had manual button pushers. And I would encourage them to give me slow pulls. So it was more like shooting a surprise bird in the woods. And one of the best things that happened to me on the grouse, on the skeet field, was my mentor at the time. He taught me to only shoot, break the front edge of the bird off. And if I do that, he'd say, "Oh, we can eat that one." And he was an old grouse hunter. If you broke the whole bird, he'd say, "Oh, a terrible shot." And he could actually, on a bright sunny day, he could actually see the shot pattern. If you watch it in a blue sky, you'll see just a little puff, almost like smoke. So he knew right where I shot. But one night he said, he shot four gauges. He said, "Tim, take this out and shoot it." And he handed me a Charles Daly 410 over and under. And he two boxes of shells. I shot a 24 and a 25 with that little gun. It was so easy to break birds with that 410. From that day on, I had to have a 410, and I bought a Browning Satori 410 with English stock. Really prefer English stocks over pistol grips. Pistol grips slow you down. They cantilever against this hand when you're mounting that gun. Once I bought that 410, my shooting, my success rate just went crazy because it was so easy to swing that little gun and keep it swinging, and it's an heirloom. It'll never be sold.
Well, you're preaching to the choir here, because I'm definitely a fan of the English straight grip guns, and I still have my old Browning Satori Upland Special, but I prefer my side-by-sides now, but they're set up very similar.
A friend of mine said if we were supposed to shoot over and unders, our eyes would have been squeezed up and down. But the guy that really is successful in the field, especially in upland hunting, is one gun man. A guy that shoots one gun all the time and shoots it very well. And I know so many, especially trap shooter. I have a lot of trap shooter friends. They're always switching guns and making excuses. But if you shoot one gun in the field and shoot it very well, it becomes an extension of you. And the muscle memory, the feel of it, it just all combines. And if you're a serious bird hunter, you should be almost obsessive compulsive in picking up that gun every possible time in the house. Anytime I walked by, I have a gun case in the basement. Every time I walked by there, I'd take that 410 out and mount it at light switches or and close my eyes and mount it and see if that sight fell on that switch, because it's all muscle memory and getting so accustomed to that gun that it's part of you. That one gun man will show you how to do it.
I have certainly found that to be the case in my experience. The more I mess around and shoot different guns, the worse I get. So I try not to do that. And I've gotten pretty good at it. I've got a gun that I really, really like. And there's very few other ones that I pick up when I'm going out for a grouse hunt. But the only time I get creative is when I go out on sharptail hunting or do something different. But when I'm in the grouse woods, I pretty much carry one gun.
And what is it?
It's a RFM Italian side-by-side, 28 gauge straight grip.
Sweet.
I've got long barrels on it. I like it, but double trigger gun. And I've been shooting that. I think this is my fourth year shooting it now, and I love it.
Sweet gun. Yeah.
I
26 inch barrels, my preference, but it's the gun you get used to and shoot well is the one to use. That's for sure.
Exactly. Yep. So there's some other things. I notated a few things. I learned in reading your article that grouse have over 4,300 feathers. Did you count them, Tim, or is that from a biology book?
A book that I'll highly recommend is called The Gallant Grouse by Cecil Heacock. Okay. It's a very easy to read book, but he goes into a lot of natural history, It's one of the reasons, one of the books I used in this study, lifetime of studying them. The other one is the New York Ruff Grouse Study. It was a multi-year.
The Bump book, yeah, right?
Gardner Bump. That book, none of us layman people could replicate that study because they had captive birds and they knew the temperature and the breath rates and everything about those birds. We couldn't do that scientifically. But every time I would read something in that book about, digestion rates and dusting and so forth, I would then go to the woods and try to verify that and study and look for that. It got so, by studying these birds and really watching, I got so that I could read their body language. By watching a grouse, once you know them intimately, you can tell exactly what they're going to do, what their next move is going to be. And that is so much pleasure to learn that. But the gallant grouse in that book, he uses some very nice pen and ink illustrations to illustrate everything in there. And he hired a woman to pluck and count the feathers on a ruff grouse. They even have little feathers inside their nostrils. And she found they had 4,342 feathers. And those feathers are 7% of a grouse's body weight. They can move all of those feathers by moving muscles in their skin. You see a grouse sitting on a sunning log in the wintertime, he looks like a ball with a little bump on top. And that little bump has two eyes in it. And he's sitting there sunning himself. You know, they can fan, restrict, fluff. This bird I was photographing a few days ago, it was cold winter day, nasty little sleep fly. He looked very, very plump. But now if you saw him on a bright sunny day, he'd be nice and thin. And I mentioned there, it was in an article in Gamekeepers magazine. It's an article in this one called The Survivalist. And I tell in there about a man who had an aggressive grouse on his property and invited me to come there and watch it and photograph it. And we drove around his big woodlot, and he owned quite a bit of ground. And it looked like it had a Gordon Goolion timber cut, little 10-acre blocks of different ages. And I said, did you manage this like this? And there were deer signs, deer rubbings, buck rubbings everywhere. And he said, no, he said, he was retired a number of years. He said, about every 10 years, I need some money. I sell off 10 acres of timber. Well, that made a grouse a just wonderful, wonderful place for grouse. But when I'd meet him up there, he'd say, look how fat he is today. On a cold day, that bird would be like this. On other days, he'd just be slim and trim. And it's all about those 4,332 feathers.
Yeah. That is one of the coolest things about birds, just the way they can sort of mold and adapt their shape or form. And I mean, you know, you mentioned the turkey earlier. Obviously, that's a perfect prime example of a turkey in full strut versus a turkey standing there. But if you've spent enough time hunting grouse and seeing grouse, you'll see them standing statuesque, still looking like a limb on a tree, or maybe puffed up, or again, like that one over your shoulder on the cover of the book. That's one of my favorite pictures. They can do so many neat things with 4,000 feathers.
If you're a serious birder, you will even see warbirds react to different temperature changes in their appearance. How the good Lord made them.
Yeah. Other things from observing the morning stretching routine. My kids got a kick out of that one. Tell me about that.
I have some videos of that. Quite often, I would, to photograph grouse, I'd want to be in the woods, like you hunt turkeys, be in there just as the sun's coming up. And in inclement days, they'll stay on the roost a good while. But it's usually right after they wake up, they'll sort of lean over and stretch one leg way back behind them and fan that wing on that side out over that and sort of shake that and stretch it and then bring that back down, shake a little bit and do it with the other side. It's fascinating to watch them do it. And you can almost hear them, imagine them saying, feels good. That's a common part of their natural history every day. And watching grouse, that article is all about a day in the life of a ruff grouse, what they do. And that's the beginning of it. They vary their timing daily, but they adhere to certain activities like preening. Grouse preen. And every now and then they'll stop and preen something or scratch an itch. It's not uncommon to see a grouse scratch, and they have parasites, especially the big flies, louse fly and lice. But they will preen sometime for an extended period every day. And it's usually they'll hop up on a log or maybe even an anthill and sit there and preen themselves. And then using a little oil from a eupropial gland atop their tail, the base of their tail, they'll get that on their beak and then comb those feathers out. And you'll see them just combing those feathers out, fluff it a little bit. And when they're all done with preening and give it a nice fluff, and it all goes right back into line, they're a beautiful, slick bird again. They're absolutely amazing, but they have a lifestyle that is very predictable through the day. I can't tell you exactly when they're going to preen, but they're going to preen sometime during the day. And very likely, if they're, depending upon the amount of parasites, they're going to dust sometime during the day too. But it's uncommon to see that. Another thing that's uncommon to see is grouse fighting. I have seen it a number of times. Springtime, when male grouse really become pugilists, and I mean, they just knock the slop out of each other and fly. And that's a real privilege when you get to see something like that. So
once or twice, I have seen two grouse squared off. In fact, there was my son and I were by our cabin a couple of years ago, and I think I got a video of it. I don't know that we saw them actually, because we kind of disturbed the scene, but we sort of interrupted them. They were right in the middle of a forest road, but they were about to fight or were fighting in the process of it. But yeah, that was a rare one, but clearly a territorial battle going on.
Oh yeah, and they're impressive when they square off and say, come on, I'm going to put up your dukes. They're really impressive, and the male grouse are something to watch. They are an impressively beautiful bird. They're not brightly colored, but they're dressed so elegantly, and feathers, they're somber colors. But one of the things you'll notice about ruffed grouse, white is one of the most, this stuff is very obvious. White-tailed deer in the woods, when he flags that tail, you see him. Grouse have so much white on them, especially on their underbellies. Tremendous amount of white, yet it's arranged in such a way that it just makes them disappear into the cover. And I've seen grouse, I'd be photographing them and look away to do something with the camera, look back and, where is he? It took me a while to find it again because they blend in so quickly. And when they don't move, they're very, very difficult to see. Movement betrays a grouse.
This is something that I feel like I've noticed, and it'll probably know it right away, and I guess it's not unusual with birds. Oftentimes the males are more sort of presentable, I guess. Like, they have this really elegant coloring and feathering, and the chest feathers on a male are oftentimes very much, I don't know how to describe it other than the females are opposite, where the females are more like mixed patterns on their chest feathers, like more camouflage, really. There's probably a very logical explanation to it, but the males often have just like a more presentable chest feather pattern, whereas it seems like the females are more spotted and speckled, if that makes any sense.
I'm so impressed that you noticed that. It's like the difference, sexual dimorphism shows tremendously in pheasants. Cock pheasant is, he's gaudy as can be. Yeah. It also shows in grouse, and you're very astute in seeing that. Hens are much more somberly colored, and often you don't see any hint of their ruff. They have a neck ruff, just like the male.
Right.
But they've got shorter tails and dimmer, more somber coloration overall. You're absolutely, absolutely right. And they're so elusive. The most difficult bird I have to photograph is hen grouse. They're very difficult to get photographs of. And when you see a hen, you better photograph it. Males are much more available for photography and for the upland hunter than are hens.
Yeah.
You're very...
In a sense, that kind of works in our favor, really, just to kill more males.
Yes, it's nature's way to protect the females. White-tailed deer. I did a story for Gamekeepers Magazine on selectively shooting a white-tailed deer to enhance the buck-to-doe ratio. And it's basically about taking the adult doe out. When fawns, the adult doe, the first year birth of a deer is almost 95% a buck fawn. It's a single fawn, and it's a buck. Her second birth will be twins, and it can be twin females. The second birth, if it's twins, male and female, the female fawn will always be bigger than the male. She is more likely to survive than this little button. It's nature's way. Save and preserve the hen for reproduction. So
Yep.
We males are unfortunately expendable.
Yeah, indeed we are. A lot of women nodding their heads, if there's any women listening. I love
one,
it.
One of the...
Oh, go ahead.
One of the great privileges Debbie and I had, I'm married to a wonderful woman who tolerated all of my grouse hunting and so forth and research, and she's participated in a lot of it. One of the great privileges we had occurred when I was sitting in a photography blind for black bear, and my cell phone, it was on silent, and it buzzed and picked it up, and it was Lisa Williams, who was at that time the rough grouse, well, the upland bird biologist for Pennsylvania. And she said, "Tim, you want to take a trip?" I said, "What?" She said, "We have collected grouse eggs, and we are collecting and have a number of grouse eggs in an incubator. They had already collected some that had never been incubated and sent them out to out west to a propagator out in Idaho." He said, "These eggs have been incubated partially, so they have to be kept in an incubator, and I need them transported to Idaho for the West Nile virus research." So we had 32 eggs in an incubator. They had to be kept at 99 degrees and 65% humidity. And Debbie and I hauled them. We were headed to Idaho, but then the propagator, who's the best in the world for grouse, said, "Hey, I'm going to be in Sioux Falls, Sioux City, Kansas, one of the western Kansas." And we met him there and exchanged those eggs. And it was a tedious trip. Every bump in the road, you know, worried us about those eggs.
Yeah.
But all 32 of them candled good, and all 32 hatched. 16 of those were exposed to West Nile virus and mosquitoes. 16 were not. They were protected. All the birds were killed. And then those 32 carcasses went to Colorado State University, where they have the best lab on blood contents. And I want to say herpetology, but that's reptiles. Anyway, they analyzed the blood, and they found that they could see antibodies in the blood of the West Nile exposed birds. And that enabled the biologists to give our participating hunters who participated in grouse and woodcock studies a little swab to swab the blood of a grouse that they killed, send it in with their weighing and report, and we could tell the percentage. We could look at that under a microscope and know what percentage of our grouse had been exposed to West Nile or had West Nile. What a wonderful concept that was. And that was all begun by a grouse hunter. A very, very savvy grouse hunter named Dick Weaver from Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, very avid grouse hunter who kept wonderful records. And he, in his journals, he was noticing that all of his covers, he had many good covers, the grouse population was declining. The habitat was perfect. The habitat was beautiful. He said, "Tim, I realized this had to be disease. This had to be a problem." So he contacted Lisa Williams, and that generated that research, which let us now monitor West Nile virus. Right now, in my county, where I used to have grouse everywhere, the only time I see a grouse is only place I see a grouse is above 1,500 feet in elevation. I don't have to go far from here to get up on the Allegheny front. With a bird I photographed 3 days ago, it was at 2,700 feet. The reason there's more there, more surviving there, is fewer mosquitoes up there to transmit the West Nile. So it's fascinating study. Fascinating.
Yeah. So have you not photographed a bird dusting?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
Oh, you have?
Yes, okay. I have. And there's two photographs probably in that Grouse and Woodcock book about it. It's very uncommon to see it. And the last time I saw it was up in near Wellsboro, PA, right along the New York line. We were camping up there and just easing along the road, and all of a sudden I saw the dust flying, and there was a hen just scooping up that dust and throwing it on herself and shaking herself. And it's when you see that, it's very, very uncommon, even though they don't do it every day. But if they're being bothered by the insects, they're going to do it. So it's fairly common, but uncommon to see. Something in private.
So. Yeah. Yeah. And that one's because I think, again, if you spend enough time in the woods and you know what to look for, it's most people have probably seen a dust bowl where you've got the little hollowed out bowl along the side of a trail. There's maybe a piece of grouse scat in there or some feathers. Yep. But again, by the time I've never seen it actually occurring. I think I flushed grouse right near there. Maybe they were in there, but by the time I would see them dusting, you know, they are already well aware of my presence and that sort of thing.
Oh, yeah.
I have seen the dust bowls, and that's one of those things you always observe.
And they will dust at the base of an old rotted tree. It looks like it's nothing but sawdust. They'll dust in that as well. And they're constantly caring for themselves and constantly working to survive. And they're wonderful at it. So one of the other things, mentioning dust, made me think of this. I was talking to a fellow recently about how a bird dog can follow a flush grouse. And how did they do that? And I said, I learned that one day by seeing it happen. I was trying to photograph this grouse, and I've had Brittany's for years. No longer have one. Just age caused that. But anyway, I'd left the Brittany out of the car, and this grouse flushed right into the sun, and it was all snow, just as clear a picture as you could see a flushing grouse. As he flew into that sun there, he left a whole trail of dust, little sloughing feathers and dust coming off of his body, a whole trail. And that is lingering on or condensing on the ground or descending to the ground. And that dog, a dog will not even hear a grouse flush, but he'll follow that and not even see it, not hear it or see it. Call him over and he'll follow where that bird flew because of that trail. Yeah. So it's seeing that. Well, anytime you see a grouse, you need to keep your mind and your eyes open and study that bird. It's such an opportunity, such a privilege just to watch them.
One of the other things I found myself kind of nodding my head as I was reading, you talked about how they use topography and it's really like getting out of inclement weather and where you might find roost pile. And that's something that a pile of poop where they've been sitting in the same place for 24 hours or so. And something immediately came to mind. One of my last grouse hunts of the year was in December after we had our winter showed up overnight for us here and really shut the hunting season down right around Thanksgiving. I didn't hunt much until it finally warmed up in December and I went back out. We didn't have a lot of snow, but I was hunting this area where it has a lot of drainages and steep ravines that kind of drain into creeks. And there was a really steep one and I was crossing one of them and I looked down and saw a big pile of grouse poop in there and just kind of was thinking, you know, there was probably a cold, windy night and he went right down in the bottom of this little ravine and sat there for a whole day or whatever and processed whatever he had been eating. So I always find that curious to pay attention to that stuff.
That pile of grouse back right up, or pile of poop back right up.
It was a really, really skinny ravine. So yeah, he was tucked in there.
Most commonly those ground roost, and they do that when there's no snow and the winter weather is really bad. They'll back right up to a stump or a tree that blocks that prevailing west wind. And they snuggle right in there and just sit there and they change their tabulation, their digestive rate with the temperature. When the temperature gets cold and they're concerned and conserving that, their 107 degree temperature, they'll maintain that, but slow their digestive rate down almost by 3/4. And when they're sitting there, they're digesting slowly from this crop down through the gizzard and then out through the intestine, pooping every now and then, discharging that. And they are so comfortable there, just enjoying life and knowing they're safe tucked back in. They also check, usually that's at a point where they have a good vision to the south and east, so they can see and hear you and I and the dog approaching. And they just sit right in there and be safe and pretty well free from harm and detection. The hunter needs to put that spot in his journal. When you find those, they will use those repeatedly. One year, the weather was, the weekend, the weather was extremely bad. We had snow and wind and sleet driving. I was in Western Maryland because their season was like 15 days longer than ours. And the habitat was alive with grouse, and I knew it. Couldn't find any in our normal spot. But on the steep hillside that went down to the Youghiogheny River, the birds were all in there on that hillside, and they ran underneath logs, backed up against trees. And when they came out of there, they went straight down the hillside, just dove down that hillside. So they were very difficult shots, but they were absolutely using the topography and the woody structures to avoid the winter chill. They're amazing survivors. They really are.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a place where I, near here, it's, you can't hunt there, but it's, I run my dogs and we exercise in there a lot throughout the whole year. And there's not a lot of grouse in there. The cover's not great. There's no forest management. It's just kind of mature forest, but there's a beaver swamp and there are some grouse in there. And there were two places that immediately came to mind. One was last winter. We had, as I was reading your article, there was last winter, we had a stretch of, before it snowed, we had a stretch of sub-zero temperatures. And I remember being out in the days following that. And there's a place where I always walk by, this root ball of an old tree that's turned up. And sure enough, there was a grouse, you know, poop pile right on the back of that root ball, blocking the, you know, facing to the east, blocking that west. And I saw that. And then earlier, just about a month ago or so, I was hiking that same trail with my boys, and we found a fresh set of grouse tracks in the powdery snow. And this is after we had some cold weather. And this just happened to be like the first morning in a few where the sun was shining and it was a nice calm morning. It was still cold, but it was sunny. We found a fresh set of grouse tracks, and my boys, they got all excited, of course, and they started following them. And just, 10 yards, my son found a pile of grouse poop, and it was, perfectly described, like in your article. This is a big gradual slope that goes down to the south. There's a beaver swamp there, so all that sun was pouring in.
Yep.
And on the north side of where he was sitting, there was a clump of hazel brush. That's like the one little bit of cover that they've got in there.
Yep.
And he was tucked right up into that hazel brush, and the sun was just pouring down. So, he could have been there 5 minutes before we were there, just kind of sitting there sunning himself.
But that is, grouse tracks are a wonderful learning experience. And yeah. After the season's closed, we have snow in the ground. One of the best things you can do is just go out and walk, follow grouse tracks. You know, I don't really want to flush the birds in, but if you follow a grouse track in the snow, it's like personal intelligence. Why was he here? What did he eat here? And you'll see what he did and where he went. All of that should be recorded here for the next time you hunt that cover. And watching and learning, I often said to, I used to give a grouse lecture at a youth camp, and I tell them all this stuff and say, knowledge is something that's like gold. It's precious and no one can take it from you. And you can gather as much of it every day of your life. You can be gathering knowledge, and grouse hunters should really work to gather knowledge on grouse for two reasons. We want to be more successful and harvest more grouse, but it also makes us appreciate that grouse so much more. They're such amazing birds. You have to revere them. And I know you do.
You're absolutely right, Tim. And clearly you have not lost that reverence for the bird. And that's why we love having you on the show and talking to you. Is there a photo that is still on your list that you've never captured? You want to capture a grouse doing a certain thing. Is there any kind of like a bucket list photo that you have?
That copulation that I said we've never seen.
Okay. Yeah.
I'll email you a photograph I call incomplete pass. It was early morning up on a state forest area, and the grassy side of the road, the birds were out there getting gravel. And that's one thing we didn't talk about. They have to have gravel. So they will frequent these road edges and disturbed areas to get that granite and usually light colored gravel for the grifts and the gizzard. But they were working in that area, picking young greens in the springtime. He was in full courtship mode. Boy, he wanted to get friendly with that hen. And she was a pretty girl. And he kept approaching her from behind. And he got real close one time, and he just reached his foot out to sort of pin her down. I thought he was going to pin her down. And I see that action. He almost got her, but she squirted out from under him. Nobody I know has ever seen grouse copulate. I believe it occurs in the dark of night around a drumming log. And one of the things we didn't talk about is the value of drumming logs. A drumming log is the social center of a grouse's habitat. When you identify a drumming log, put that in your journal. And some birds will have not just one log, they'll have a couple of them. Their social circle is going to include about a 500-yard circle around that log where they frequent quite often, and where the hens come. I believe the springtime breeding, I told you about how they'll drum 3, 4, 5 in the morning. I believe the spring breeding copulation occurs right near that log in the darkness of night and remembering to hunt in the areas. If you find a darning log, hunt a circle around it and expand that circle. Almost surely you'll flush a grouse because that is that's a social circle. The other thing I should mention is the fall shuffle. I don't know if you've ever, I had one really good opportunity to photograph what had happened here. Usually about late September, the young males, you know, you've got a brood of grouse that hatched out and she may have 14. The young males need to get away from those sisters so we don't have the incestuous breeding. And they will just get up. Often it's attributed grouse flying into cars and sides of buildings and usually reflective windows is not uncommon at that time of year. That's often attributable to, oh, they're drunk on, they ate too many grapes and got drunk. I doubt that that ever happens. But crazy flight happens, and it's a dispersal thing. These young males have to get out of that and go find that cover, their home cover with all their siblings. They've got to go find a new spot. And they will just take off and fly like a rocket. One of them, I got called to a lady's house just at the edge of our town here. The grouse had crashed through a window and left a hole about this big in the window, knocked a lamp aside, crossed the 10-foot wide bedroom or 12-foot wide bedroom, and it was 6 feet down a hallway into a closet. Now, he had to have a tremendous speed on when he did that.
Yeah.
He was getting the heck out of Dodge. He was moving to a new location. I was able to photograph that situation. I actually put him back up by the lamp that he'd knocked over, but through a window across a 12-foot bedroom with 6 more feet down. That's a tremendous.
Yeah, it's some velocity.
Impact. Yeah. But they do that. That's part of their history.
Yeah. I love it. Well, I did, just as we wrap up here, I did bring these. We'll put links, but hopefully folks can have a chance to read the winter issue of the Covers magazine from Rough Grouse Society, American Woodcock Society, the Upland Lifestyle. That was kind of the article was sort of the basis. And then if folks want to hear more of Tim's wisdom, I could think of no better place to do that than Grouse and Woodcock, The Birds of My Life. That book is still available, right, Tim?
It's still available. It has gone up in price. The standard edition was $100. It's now $150. And that limited edition, which is an elegant volume, that was 300. There are just a few of the limited. There were only 100 of those made. There's a few of them left, I believe about 10. And that now is they've increased from 300 to 500. And we've seen.
Do you have to go to Wild River Press? Or are they on Amazon?
Log on to Wild River Press and then click hunting. Wild River Press is a wonderful publishing agency. They do high quality publications. And if you check on the category hunting and then go down to bird hunting or upland hunting, that book will appear there.
Is that Tom Perrow?
Tom Perrow.
Am I remembering that?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's the publisher there. They do wonderful work. I have illustrated other books for him. The way I got to meet him is he contacted the Rough Grouse Society for a book that he was publishing called A Passion for Grouse. And you're familiar with that. And he needed rough grouse photographs for that book. And so the Rough Grouse Society said, contact Tim Flanagan. He's our bird photography man. So we talked and chatted and actually turned him over to my wife. He wanted all these photographs for free. And said, probably should sell you if you were in the business.
Talk to my negotiator.
So we eventually, I think there's 10 inside live bird photographs and the cover on that book, my photographs, thanks to Debbie. And that generated a friendship. Since illustrated two volumes of Turkey Men. It's about all the men have killed in every state where they're legal. And illustrated a book, fascinating book called Why Women Hunt. And every chapter in that book is written by a separate woman about a separate species. And he said, Tim, do you have photographs for this book? I said, what do you need? And he starts off, well, I need whitetails and mule deer and ducks and rabbits and... So it was a tremendous amount, but we illustrated that book. All the live animal photographs in that book are ours. And it's been a good relationship. But A Passion for Grouse is a great read. All the individual chapters are written by grouse experts and hunters such as yourself. And I just contribute the photography there. The Grouse and Woodcock book that we did, every photograph and every word in there is mine. And it's received a lot of good comments, a lot of acclaim. Matter of fact, there's a special edition of it called the Governor's Edition, preserved in the Pennsylvania State Library in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. That's quite an honor for that book. One of the reasons for that honor is it's our state bird. Pennsylvania is the only state honors the ruff grouse as their state bird. And that occurred back in 1931. It was proposed by a lady from the Women's Garden Club, not a hunter. A Women's Garden Club suggested it, and the then was called the General Assembly approved that with a certain pamphlet law that the ruff grouse is our state avian symbol. So it's that being our state avian symbol and the fact that the book was written by a Pennsylvania game warden made that sort of special to Pennsylvania. So it's enshrined. And I think the quality, at least I hope so. Yeah, that's why it's enshrined in a special edition, a special honored place in the state library. Excuse me for blowing off some steam here.
Oh, no, not at all. No, no. Both of the books you mentioned, Grouse, Woodcock, A Passion for, I have them both. We've talked about them both on the show before. They're phenomenal, of course, full of great wisdom and knowledge, some of it yours, some of it from others, but obviously tons and tons of photos. You did tell me, I did not know that there was a turkey book, and that is something that you wouldn't know this about me, Tim, but that has become an interest of mine as turkeys have had more of a presence here. I'm going to have to reach out to Mr. Perro about those turkey books because I want to get my hands on those.
There's two volumes. It's called Turkey Men.
And okay.
Illustrating that book actually resulted in this Grouse and Woodcock book.
Okay.
Most of the chapters in there are written by Tom of interviews he did with people, like Rob Keck is one of the interviews.
Okay.
And he had just interviewed someone in Northern Virginia, and he was passing through this area. He's from Seattle, as you know. He was passing through and he contacted me. He said, could I stop by? I said, absolutely. So he spent most of the day here and we had lunch together. And I said, could I show you? We're talking about grouse and woodcock. And I said, could I show you my slide program? And I have in-depth slide program on ruff grouse, another one on woodcock. And he sat down here at a separate computer. And we were clicking through this and I was telling him about this. And he said, Tim, this is a book. If you write it, I'll publish it. And that's how this book came about. By the way, one of the interesting chapters there, we talked about shooting, and hunting ruff grouse is a lot about, you know, we kill these birds. And we have to shoot very, very well to accomplish that. One of the chapters in there is all about shooting and about how my mentor taught me to shoot these birds in the head and follow through and so forth. That's a chapter worth reading right before your fall hunt. And then picking that gun up and practicing with it. Even in the field, one of the things I did, if we stopped and took a break, a lot of my woodcock hunting was with Dr. Al Geis, who was Mr. Woodcock for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We hunted together for 35 years. Every hunt with him was a college education, you know, college class on woodcock.
Yeah.
And he started the woodcock wing bee, by the way. Well,
okay.
After any time we would take a break, the first thing I did was mount that gun about five or six times and then head out with the dogs. And the dogs were so in tune to that gun. When you did that mounting, they'd come alive. So, whoa, it's going to shoot.
Yep.
It's so important to learn to shoot well and then practice mounting that gun every time you can.
So, yeah. I love it. Yeah. Well, the other thing I want to give you one chance to plug this before we do wrap up is I was mentioning to you the other day that I've been reading a bunch of thriller novels and some kind of northern Minnesota and wildlife stuff. I love that stuff, especially this time of year. Your books are not fiction, but you've got the poacher series. Tell me about those briefly.
I was a very aggressive poacher hunter, you know, and you know, game warden hunts. Yes. Men, really. This book, Night Killers, was the first that I wrote, and it's a every chapter in this book is a different encounter with a poacher. And same with this book. This is the second one, follow-up. Every story in there is a personal encounter that my deputies and I engaged in. I was usually working by myself. But when the greatest compliments I get from people that buy these books, and they become quite popular, is, wow, it feels like you're riding right along, like you're right there in the... So for a writer, that's very, very, very rewarding. It's fun writing these books. And the reason they're right on is because through the 30 years that I did this work, I was keeping notes. I was writing these stories as I went along. So I'm not just relying on memories. I have a third one pretty well written. The one I had one more chapter to it. that'll probably be the end of that. But they're enjoyable reads because you can just read one chapter at a time. It's here's an event, you know, he almost got shot or whatever. I have been shot at, punched, kicked, hit with cars, choked.
Jeez.
You name it, my coat, my hat ripped off, and my shirts ripped and shirt sleeves ripped off by people. And the worst one was on the first year, my first year in the field, a man tried to kill me with a 12 gauge and ended up splitting my head open. So I lost a lot of blood, but survived that encounter. And that encounter, at that time, I was very naive. And that encounter made me very cautious for the rest of my life. And I tell people, you know, a game warden should be the sportsman's friend. He should never be perceived as nitpicking. And there are some officers like that. The sportsman paid my paycheck. And I was a sportsman before being a game warden, and always considered myself sportsman first. So when I approached people, I had to be absolutely alert for danger, because it happens suddenly. You have a gun and a muzzle in your face very, very suddenly, especially with coon hunters, night hunters. Oh, unbelievable. But it made me very, very cautious. But I was always friendly to hunters, because they're my friends. They're my fellows, you know, fellow hunters. So I tell these young officers, you need to be able to project an image of Barney Fife on the outside and Dirty Harry, while hiding the alertness of Dirty Harry on the inside. You have to be ultra alert and listen very closely. The game warden's greatest weapon is his mind and his mouth. Effective communication will keep you from rolling around in the dust and fighting or getting shot. So these stories are all about that lifestyle. Thank you for mentioning it.
So, you've crammed a lot of living into those 80 years, Tim.
It's been fun. It's been fun. And like I said, from 40 years, from 40 on, you're going to enjoy it more now than you ever did. As every year goes by, you appreciate life even more. That's one of the reasons why the older hunters don't care much for killing. They would much rather mentor a youth and get him started in hunting. As far as mentorship, it's wonderful to mentor a youth, but we should also remind fellow hunters like yourself, somebody probably mentored you. As you get older, one of the most satisfying things I did was take my grandfather on his last fishing trip. I owed him that.
Yeah.
So remember the guys that mentored you, and if you can, take them on a hunt or a fishing trip. So it's all great.
Well said. Well said, Tim.
And the main
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The main bag limit of hunting and fishing, the consumptive sports, is the memories. It's not the dead birds. It's not the mountain on the wall. It's the memories here. Memories of great hunts, great friends, great dogs. That's the real bag limit.
That means more to me with the passing of each season. So I definitely can understand where you're coming from, Tim.
Well, and right now you're building memories with suns coming up. You're at the memory building stage in life. Some of the finest memories I've ever experienced was guiding people into their first rough grouse. That first rough grouse that comes to hand can be a life-changing event. It certifies you as an effective wing shooter. There's no occurrence that does it any better than that. Taking a rough grouse on the wing, the first one, real special memory. It never fades. Never fades.
Well, if I've learned anything about my listeners over the years, it's that they love book recommendations just as I do, Tim. So we've got a bunch of them here today. So I thank you for that. We'll put links in the show notes for all of those. Thank you for taking the time today, sharing your knowledge and wisdom with us. And we'll have to do it again sometime, my friend.
Very good. Thank you. Thank you very, very much for this privilege. What an honor. And just chatting with a fellow grouse hunter is wonderful.
I enjoyed it as well. So keep up the great work. Tim, hang on with me for just a second. That does it for this episode of the Birdshot Podcast. Everybody, thanks for listening. Hey, everyone, it's your host, Nick here. One more thing before you go. Thanks for joining us on this episode of the Birdshot Podcast presented by Onyx Hunt. Be sure to subscribe and follow the show so you don't miss our next episode. And if you really love the show and want to contribute above and beyond what you already do by listening, you can do so by joining our Patreon community. Click the link in the show notes to this episode. You can sign up for as little as $5 a month. And if you do, I will send you some of these Birdshot Podcast can coolers and stickers as a thank you for doing so. Thanks, everyone. Catch you on the next episode of the Birdshot Podcast.